listening to A Closer Look, a program from Alaska Public Media. I'm Lori Townsend, and today's program features a discussion with mariner, surfer, and author Jonathan White about his book Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. White spent 10 years researching tides and the global effects of tidal action after his boat nearly sank in Alaska. White grew up on the California coast. He built a sailboat in college and spent a lot of time on the water. In his 20s, he bought a 65-foot wooden schooner and started a school on the boat, conducting seminars on natural history, whale research, psychology, and writing, all along the California coast and up into southeast Alaska, where he almost lost the boat in a large gale and tide.
In Killeen Bay, on the north tip of Kruzoff Island, and the boat went down. We dragged anchor in a gale, and the boat went down in the mud. And when the tide came back up, she was stuck in the mud, so she didn't want to right herself. And the tide just flooded the boat. And literally, it was almost a loss. But miraculously, the boat came back up. And after that incident, I decided it was time to learn about the tide. And of course, I knew the moon had something to do with it, but I wasn't sure what, like a lot of people. And so I thought I'd read a couple of books and spend a couple of weeks and learn everything there was to know about the tide. But I was really wrong. Because the more I read, the more amazing, the more fantastic and complex and poetic it became. So pretty soon, a couple of articles turned into 10, and then 50, and then 300. And a couple of weeks turned into 10 years.
Tell us about where you traveled in your research when you were working on this book.
Yes. Well, the premise of the book is really it's about a journey of a sailor and surfer to understand the tides. And what I did was I ended up taking some element of the tide in each chapter, and I went someplace in the world where that was really dramatically at play. So for the largest tidal bores in the world, where the water or where the tide comes up the river in the form of a wave or a solid wave of water, like on Turnagain Arm, I went to Chentong River in China, and it's the largest in the world. It gets up to 25 feet. And then for tide energy, I went to Scotland and the Orkney Islands and Chile. For the spiritual history of the tide, I went to Mont-Saint-Michel in France. And I went to Italy and the Panama and the Arctic and BC and the Bay of Fundy and all over the place.
What does the research that you've done reveal about our evolving understanding about tides, going, you know, from your research on what the ancient beliefs were about why tides occur to today's science?
For 99.999% of human history, we had no idea how the tides worked. It really wasn't until the end of the scientific revolution when Newton and his colleagues gave us the laws of planetary motion and gravity so that we could just get a finger hold on what was going on with the tide. And it's taken us over 300 years since then to know what we know today. And we know a lot, but we don't know everything. But for all those years prior to the scientific revolution, in one form or another, our worldview was that the Earth was a stationary center of the universe. And with that worldview, there's no way we could understand the mechanics of the tide, how it actually worked. But there was a lot of speculation. So all those years of speculation, for example, that the moon created the tide by heating rocks on the bottom of the ocean floor. And when those rocks were heated, the water warmed and expanded, and that was high tide. And when the moon traversed the sky and went away, the rocks cooled, the water cooled and contracted, and that was low tide. So there's a lot of stories like this. So the Chinese thought that the tide was created by a dragon going in and out of its cave. And some people thought it was breathing, like breathing of the earth itself, a long inhale and exhale. And Leonardo da Vinci was convinced it was the breathing of a large beast, one big beast. and he tried to calculate the size of its lung. So there's a tremendous amount of stories around this. And again, for most of human history, we had to speculate about it. Now, on the other hand, there's a deep and rich history with native peoples that, and of course, they developed a very practical understanding of what they saw going on in the heavens and what they saw going on at their feet in the intertidal zone. So for it, there's not a good written record of this, but for certain, these people developed a very keen and deep understanding of this practical knowledge of what was going on and passed it on from generation to generation.
It's interesting to hear you say, you know, we know a lot now, but we still don't know that much about tides, because I think it's easy for people to make the assumption, it's gravitational pull, moon cycle, what's there to know beyond that? So how much is known and how much is not known, and why is that?
Yeah, really. Like Lori, the tide comes in, the tide goes out. I mean, what more could there be to it? And that's what I thought, you know. But, well, we do know a lot about the tide. We just don't know everything. There are still some mysteries. And one of them, for example, is what the tide's relationship is to seismic activity, volcanoes and earthquakes. It's been suspected for many, many years that there is a relationship there, not just the tug of the moon and the sun on the Earth, but also the tremendous amount of weight of water shifting around the planet the way it does, right? So I think in the coming years, we're going to be able to corroborate that there is indeed a relationship there. Another one is biological rhythms. We know that there are a lot of animals in the intertidal zone, and some offshore and some even terrestrial but coastal animals that live by the tide or by the moon. But we don't know how those things work. Like, for example, in the first chapter of the book, I talk about a very small mud shrimp that lives in the Bay of Fundy, and it's called a Corophium. And this little tiny mud shrimp, the size of a grain of rice, has two tide clocks in it. One tells it what the tide is doing on a daily basis, because if this little animal came out of the mud too early or too late, it would be swept away by the very violent tides there. They have a record tide of 56 or 54 feet, 6 inches, the highest tides in the world. Now, they also have a second tide clock that tells them the highest tides of the month for spawning purposes. So this little creature has two tide clocks in it, and we don't know where they are, and we don't know how they work. So there's a lot that we are going to explore there and learn about. And the number of marine scientists that I talked to speculated that we're going to find over the years that not only how these clocks work and where they're located, but also that there are vestiges of these same clocks in every living being on the planet. So we have not only these solar clocks, but we also have these lunar and tidal clocks.
Why are tides so different in other places, in various places in the world? We often hear here in Alaska that Turnagain Arm has one of the largest tide exchanges of anywhere in the world. First of all, is that true? And secondly, why do they vary so much?
Well, yes, it is true. So Turnagain Arm has what they call a mega tide. And I would say that there's probably, my guess is about 10 other tides around the world that have such a tide, a very large tide. The largest tide in the world, as I mentioned, is the Bay of Fundy. But also north of the Bay of Fundy in Ungava Bay, which is just about 200 miles south of the Arctic Circle and near Hudson Strait. And it also has a rival worldwide record tide of 54 feet, 6 inches. And what's unusual about that is it's not just the highest tide by 6 inches or a foot. It's the highest tide by 10 feet. I mean, it's really extraordinary. So one of the chapters I went out to answer that question, why would you have a large tide like that? And what's going on? And why would you have a smaller tide in places like the Mediterranean or the Baltic Sea or the Gulf of Mexico? So getting back to your original question about why you have these different tide regimes, to kind of boil it down, the tides are about a lot of different things. And one of the challenges I had in studying it was that you have to be willing to unravel a layer and then only to find that there's another layer. And it's really quite fascinating because we're not alone in our challenge about understanding the tide. I mean, even Aristotle was rumored to have killed himself because he couldn't understand the tide. He's rumored to have thrown himself in the ocean saying, "Comprehend me since I cannot comprehend thee." And all the way through time, noted scientists have had challenges with this. So it's very complicated. But anyway, if you keep boiling the soup long enough, you finally get down to vibration, and more specifically about resonance, which is when something vibrates in response to something else. And in this case, the ocean basins of the world are vibrating or resonating with some note from the universe. And that is a frozen beat of a position of the moon or the sun relative to the earth. So we know, for example, when the moon is full or new, we have our largest tides, meaning high highs and low lows. And so you can call that or think of it as a note or a beat. And the oceans respond to those beats in different ways, depending on what their shape is, the depth of the water, even the temperature and salinity of the water. And so it's really all about resonance. So the Bay of Fundy is a highly resonant basin with the moon. And so is Ungava Bay, and so is Turnagain Arm. But the Mediterranean and the Baltic and the Gulf of Mexico are not resonant basins. So they don't respond as much.
Is there any sort of effect on humans and other living creatures that are in those places that's different from people where the tides don't have that resonance? Is there any sort of
great question?
Is there any sort of impact?
Yeah. Well, you would think so. And it kind of gets back to the other question about biological rhythms. And one of the things I found in the book, the subtitle, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean, didn't come until later. And I was surprised to learn in all my travels and talking to people just how deep the relationship was with the tide and the coastal environment. Coastal ocean environment. And I kept following that. And I talked to a lot of people, even in Mont-Saint-Michel in France. I talked to the monks who have a spiritual practice there, yet they have a 45-foot tide there, and that monastery is completely tide-wrapped every day. And I knew that that tide, extraordinary phenomenon, must have an influence on their spiritual life. So that chapter is really about me going there and interviewing the monks about the relationship of the tide with their spiritual practice. And it was a fascinating thing, but it sort of distills a relationship, I think, that lots of people have, people who live on the coast and have had for many, many hundreds, maybe thousands of years.
How do especially large tides affect the ecosystem?
Well, tremendously, actually. One of the functions of the tide is mixing, right? And like in the Bay of Fundy, the tide is considered to be the predominant factor in taking nutrients from rivers outflow and mixing it with nutrients from the ocean and spreading it around. And so wherever you have an extreme tide, you have a lot of mixing and you have a very, very rich ecological environment.
You're listening to A Closer Look. I'm Lori Townsend, and today's program features a discussion with author Jonathan White on his book, Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. You talked a little bit about this when you were talking about the monks and the spiritual connection to tides and oceans, but what else did you learn about the different ways that people interact with their local oceans, how people who live by the rhythm of the sea change from place to place.
Yes, and considerably, actually. One of the things I found is that wherever you find a large tide, it plays a larger role in the people who live near it. Like, for example, in China, I mentioned the Chentong River and the largest tidal bore in the world there. And that tidal bore has come up that river every tide, twice a day, for 2,500 years. So they have this long history of culture, science, poetry, literature around this tidal bore, myth, rich with myth. So it's completely ingrained in the culture of this place where they live here, 300 miles up that river, on each side of the river. And they have a very spiritual view of the river that's very much alive now. And another place I went to was the San Blas Islands off of Panama. And these are island group that's about 350 islands east of Panama that stretch almost down to Colombia. And those islands are occupied by the Cunayala Indians. And they have two views about the tide. One is that it's a spiritual visitor from another dimension, come to check up on the village. And if that tide finds that everything is okay, it goes out like it normally would. But if it finds it's not okay, it stays. So this is a way that they look at sea level rise right now, and they are suffering from it. These are very low-lying coral islands, and the tide is not large. They're 10 inches, maybe a foot, but it's always at their ankles. And they also have sober-minded scientists within their community that tell them, if sea level rises 3 feet in the next 50 years, as it's conservatively estimated to do, they will lose all their island homes and they need to move. So they look at it both ways, simultaneously. They are making practical moves to find another location, but they also look at it as a spiritual problem.
What's the convergence? This is kind of intertwined through a lot of what you've been talking about, but the convergence of climate change science and effects on tides and how that may change in the future.
Yes. Well, the tide is, of course, very related to sea level rise. In some ways, sea level rise is a large scale tide, that comes a sea level that changes over time. And of course, sea level change is not new for any of us. Geologically speaking, 14,000 years ago, sea level was 450 feet lower than it is today. And 19 million years ago, it was 150 feet higher than it is today. So over time, the sea level is always changing. And technically, the tide is an astronomically influenced change in sea level that happens on top of the surface of that, right? However, because of what I was talking about earlier, this resonant quality of the basins, as sea level changes, as it either rises or falls, it changes the resonant quality of these basins. So one basin could actually become more resonant and have a higher tide with even a small amount of sea level change, and another basin might lose their tide. So it's really, it's changing all the time, and it's hard to predict. But as an example, 3,500 years ago, the Bay of Fundy didn't have a large tide. It really wasn't until sea level rose enough to flood over George's Bank and into the bay when it suddenly became resonant with the moon. And then you started to have the large tides. But that's 3,500 years ago. That's a blink of an eye from geological point of view.
Would you like to read some from your book now?
So this is a section from the second chapter, which called A Star of Our Life, which is really takes place at the Mont Saint-Michel. And again, I went there to interview the monks. And like a lot of places I went to, I had to go more than once because I couldn't find the story the first time. And so I'd go and I'd find out what was going on. And then I'd come away thinking about, well, how do I get back, or what is the right way into this story? And the Mont Saint-Michel, there's 7 or 8 monks that live there. And it's a UNESCO heritage site, so there's millions of tourists that go there. So it was very hard for me to find my way into the monks that first time. So I left and I hired a guide. And over 2 years, she interpreted my letters to them. And finally, I got permission to a silent lunch and a half-hour interview. I got to pick my time. So I picked the largest tide of the year, and I went there. And that chapter is really all about this interview with the monks, the silent lunch and the interview. So this is a piece from that chapter. I know tomorrow I will meet the monks, but tonight I ponder a letter sent earlier from Brother Francois Marie. The abbey, he wrote, is a jewel set in a beautiful case, the bay. Isn't beauty a language through which God and mankind want to meet? If beauty is a language, then Mont Saint-Michel is well spoken tonight. At the western ramparts, where a couple of hours ago I had watched the flood's advancing wave, I now study the ebb tide's fingers withdrawing in the inky light. I'm struck by the different voices I hear in the tide in the monastery. The abbey speaks of human achievement, built painstakingly in service to the Archangel Michael, a guardian and dragon slayer. The monument is an eloquent testament to humanity's insatiable desire for connection and belonging to God, to nature, to other humans. The stone heft speaks of permanence, a longing for the eternal. The tide is another kind of eloquence. It's the moon's voice on earth, spoken in perfect synchrony. What the moon does, the tide does. What the moon is, the tide is. Shifting by day but repeating a larger pattern, the tide mirrors the moon's paradox of change and changelessness. In its repetition, it personifies eternity. In its constant flux, it reminds us of what we can't control. It reminds us that our fortresses are impermanent.
Jonathan, you're a surfer. You spend a lot of time in and on the water. Did you learn things while writing this book that really surprised you?
Oh, so many things. So many things. In fact, you could track this whole process as a jump from one amazing fact to another. You know, one of them, for example, is that, you know, the tide is a long, low wave that travels around the world at the speed of a modern jet, 450 miles per hour. And it's so surprising because we don't experience it as fast moving at all, right? When we stand on the coast, we see first the trough of that wave or low tide, and then about 6 hours later, we see the crest of that wave. And then another 6 hours plus or minus, we see the trough again, low tide. So 12 hours plus or minus from crest to crest. I mean, we experience that as a very slow moving phenomenon. But this is a very long, low wave that's traveling to the world that fast. And it has no beginning, it has no end. So it's fascinating. Another fascinating thing is the tides create friction by rubbing against the ocean floor. So much so that cumulatively around the globe is a force that slows down the rotation of the Earth. Tide energy rubbing against the ocean floor slows down the rotation of the Earth. And so by a very small amount every day, the Earth is turning slower and our days are getting longer. So about 400 million years ago, our day was 21 hours long, not 24, because of the tide. And that same energy is pushing the moon away at the rate of about 10 feet in a human lifetime. So the moon that causes the tide is being pushed away by the tide. So again, many millions of years ago, the moon was much closer to the Earth. And the speculation is that we had tides of 100 to 200 feet every couple hours, completely washing over all the land masses.
That's just mind-boggling, especially because life feels like it's moving so much faster today. And to find out that we're actually slowing down is strangely comforting.
I know. So you get more done in a day, actually. If you wait till next week, you'll have a couple more seconds to do it.
So, Jonathan, if you had known then what you know now about tides, would you have come so close to losing your boat in Alaska?
Oh, gosh, I wish, but I don't think so. That was a completely a boater operator error. That was in the days, by the way, you didn't have all the electronics that would beep and so forth, alarm when you got into shallower water. It was just simply dragging, then going into really loose mud. So I didn't feel it. I didn't feel the bump or anything hitting a rock. It was just sliding into this mud. It's not the first time I've gone aground, I must say, you know.
What do you want people to learn and take away from reading this fascinating book that you've put together on tides?
Oh, well, one is just to appreciate that how complex and beautiful this subject is, really. And there's, you know, one of the things I've come to is that, you know, there are whatever the statistic is, 75% of our population live along the coast. But I've come to the realization that really we're all coastal. You know, the planet is 75% ocean, so you're never very far from it. Even if you're in Ohio, you're coastal. And so this is a phenomenon that affects everybody. It affects the whole planet. And especially as our attention turns to sea level rise and global warming and acidification and so forth, the oceans become increasingly more important. And the more that we can learn, the more we learn to love it and understand it and want to save it.
Jonathan White is the author of Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. You've been listening to A Closer Look. I'm Lori Townsend. If you missed part of today's program, you can hear it in full on our website, alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening.